for 30 years. So I guess I am going to say it's significant. And I've generally been in institutions that have been very focused on climate and carbon dioxide, and I'm always shouting at them, please remember ozone as well. It's important to include ozone in all our climate projections. So I think ozone has generally been neglected as a climate gas when it is pretty important. Probably about the third most important greenhouse gas. So carbon dioxide is obviously by far the most dominant, and then comes methane, and then ozone is the third most important gas.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
It is strange. With all the conversations I've had with scientists, ozone very seldom comes up. Has it been included in the IPCC models?
Yes, it has, and that I've been responsible for building some of those models or running some of those models. So I've made sure that certainly it's something that's addressed and assessed and calculated. But I think it still deserves more attention than it should. It's often regarded as a bit of an add-on that they're slightly unwilling to put in or put in under process because of bullying from us atmospheric chemists saying you mustn't forget ozone. But hopefully with this paper it'll become much more obvious to people that it's something that should be really treated very seriously in these climate models and given the full consideration.
So, Bill Collins, when your team adds up all the ways ozone high and low adds to warming, what is the total effect? Can we get a measurement out of that?
Well, so we report these things in a slightly obscure term called the radiative forcing, which is basically how much energy the gas is trapped. And we recalculated this value using these up-to-date models, and particularly a rather new method of calculating this radiative forcing that accounts for all the meteorological changes that happen as well. And we came up with a number that's 0.27 watts per meter squared, and that probably won't mean much to many people. But the previous number in the IPCC going out to 2050 was 0.19. So we've showed it's significantly larger than was estimated in the latest IPCC report. However, if we're comparing this to carbon dioxide, then that's now close to 2 watts per meter squared. So, you know, we're nothing like as, ozone is nothing like as important as carbon dioxide. And as we were saying about healing the ozone hole, really, yes, we should be worried that it makes reducing global warming more difficult, but carbon dioxide is by far the most important greenhouse gas, and so whatever we do, we just need to keep reducing carbon dioxide as well. The reason for the ozone forcing, part of it was because of recovery of the ozone layer, so that's a bit of a trade-off. But of course, as we were talking, the ozone pollution at ground level is both damaging and warming, so we can actually take strong steps to reduce the amount of climate warming from ozone if we reduced our ground level pollution. And not our study, but similar studies with similar models that I was indeed involved with have shown that if we really put stringent efforts in to clean up pollution, the amount of ozone we can reduce at the surface actually outweighs the greenhouse contribution from the recovery in the stratosphere. So we can actually turn ozone into a good news story if we really focus on reducing ground level pollution.
So does that ground level ozone eventually drift up into the stratosphere, or is the formation of stratospheric ozone a completely different setup?
It's actually the other way around. So stratospheric ozone wends its way down to the troposphere because it's so there's so much more of it in the stratosphere. I said something like 2 parts per million as opposed to a few tens of parts per billion down in the troposphere. So it was thought for a long time, actually, that most of the ozone we see at ground level came from the stratosphere. I said it was only research in Los Angeles smogs in the 1950s when we realized we were actually making a lot of it ourselves. But and another question people have had in the past is, could we solve the ozone hole by pushing up our ground level ozone into the stratosphere? And the answer is unfortunately no, because it's so much more concentrated in the stratosphere that even if we could somehow direct air from the ground level up into the stratosphere, it's not concentrated enough to help mend the ozone hole.
One of the big unknowns in models and in our future is cloud formation. More clouds cool the Earth, of course, with their shade. Does ozone influence cloud formation, and is that ozone stratospheric or ground level?
So that's actually what our study found, and it's probably the first time really anyone's looked at this in any level of detail. We found actually that both stratospheric and ground level ozone reduced the amount of clouds. So that can indeed, that would increase the amount of warming because it would let more sunlight in towards the Earth's surface. But actually, clouds themselves could also act in a bit like the greenhouse effect. So not only do they stop sunlight coming in, but they trap the heat going out. That's actually why the coldest days are usually the clearest days. A cloudy day really doesn't ever get as cold as a clear day because the clouds themselves act as a blanket. And it turns out that the highest level clouds, so round about sort of 10 kilometers or something, have a stronger effect as a blanket, as effectively another greenhouse gas, than they do in blocking the sunlight from reaching the Earth. So you might think that clouds always cool the climate, but they can certainly, in high clouds, can warm the climate as well.
So I assume we don't have a reliable way to measure ozone levels in pre-industrial times, and if so, that would make it hard to know where we're going. How did your team deal with that problem in this new study?
So we particularly didn't look at the pre-industrial level. So that's something that past studies have focused a lot on, what's the change in ozone between the 1850s and the present day, was we were much more looking at the future changes in ozone, where we certainly have good measurements of present day ozone. So that was one way, or particularly that meant our study didn't need to consider that we don't really have good measurements of pre-industrial ozone.
Your study assumed the shared socioeconomic pathway SSP3-7 scenario from the IPCC. That would make Earth over 3 degrees C hotter than pre-industrial by end of century, and it is the direction we're going in right now. And the scenario includes continuing high aerosol pollution. What if public pressure forces governments to really clean up the air? Would that change predictions for ozone changes and ozone-forced warming?
Oh, absolutely. This predicted scenario, because I wanted to see what would be the impact of increased levels of pollution. But absolutely, we hope we're not going down that trend at all. In earlier studies, have looked at the effect of cleaning up pollution, and that shows a really important effect. So absolutely, if we take strong action to clean up pollutants, and these pollutants are particularly oxides of nitrogen and hydrocarbons, which come out of things like vehicle exhaust or power station chimneys and so on. Hopefully, countries will have an important effect on reducing ground level ozone. So that's an important health benefit, but will also give you the climate benefit as well.
We've been publishing about ozone and warming and atmospheric chemistry since 2006. In that year, you co-authored the paper Radiative Forcing Since Pre-Industrial Times Due to Ozone Change in the Troposphere and the Lower Stratosphere. What are the major lessons learned on this subject in the last 20 years or so?
So I would say that this particular study, as I said, it incorporated a lot more of the meteorological effects of ozone. So those past studies, we had to calculate the climate effect in a separate model to the one that we were calculating the ozone in. whereas in the most recent study, we used climate models with chemistry embedded. And so because we had the same model doing the climate and the chemistry, we could investigate the effect of the ozone on the clouds and on the amount of water vapor and on the different temperatures at different levels in the atmosphere as well. So doing this much more complete calculation, including all these meteorological factors, I think has given us a really good new understanding of the impact of ozone on climate.
In 2005, the UK government led a conference called Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change. And in that conference, they talked about a safety limit of around 400 parts per million or so CO2. And now here we are 20 years later, and we're past that, well past. We're up at 425 at least. Does that mean that it's getting too late to avoid dangerous climate change?
No, it doesn't. It certainly doesn't from a physical climate point of view. We've shown, and one of the biggest, I think, advances in climate science, that if we could stop the emissions of carbon dioxide, that would actually stop the warming. So we're not ever on physical. So we can take action and we can reduce, we can stop the further warming. So it's really a political question. So I think perhaps your question should be maybe put to a politician is whether they have the political will to stop emitting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
As we wrap up here, are there ozone mysteries still to crack? What are you working on?
So interesting do in this study. So we separated the effect of these ozone-depleting substances, chlorofluorocarbons and so on, but identify which pollutants were responsible for the changes in the ground-level ozone. As I said, these are a mixture of oxides of nitrogen and various different hydrocarbons. So a study that we are just, in fact, the reason I'm in a hotel is because I'm at a conference, and today we were discussing how we were going to assess these different hydrocarbons and run experiments to calculate what impact each individual hydrocarbon has. So that's where we're going next. And that will provide quite valuable policy information, because we say, oh, we must reduce the pollutants to produce ozone. Then a policymaker could say, well, which particular pollutants are most effective? You know, should we address first? Which ones should we target to have the best effect in reducing ground-level ozone? So we are just planning some model experiments that would address exactly that question.
From the University of Reading, we've been speaking with William J. Collins, Professor of Climate Processes. He is lead author in the paper titled Climate Forcing Due to Future Ozone Changes, an Intercomparison of Metrics and Methods. That is an open access paper. You can look at it yourself and find out quite a bit. Find links and more notes in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Bill, thank you for sharing this new science with us.
It's been my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Perhaps some people hold a dark concept of climate conquest. They don't reduce greenhouse gases or clean up deadly air or get off fossil dependence. They, or we, think industrial tools ensure our survival, while other countries or races are hurt by the ongoing climate disasters. We win and they lose. It's a sick logic where everyone and every species loses to a destabilized climate. Case in point, Pakistan. Pakistan endured a string of spectacular climate-driven disasters. With over 1,300 glaciers, Pakistan has the largest volume of glacial ice outside the poles. But with smashing heat, glaciers fail, leaving outbursts of water and rock to wash away everything and everyone downstream. In addition, significant parts of the country flood at the same time during abnormal extreme rain events. That just happened. Lives and livelihoods are lost along with homes and business. There is no insurance and no aid to rebuild or replant. Some families never recover. In addition and separate from that, significant parts of the country have flooded at the same time during abnormal extreme rains that just happened. Lives and livelihoods are lost along with homes and businesses. There is no insurance and no aid to rebuild or replant. Some families never recover. Who cares? Pakistan is a nuclear power. They just made a mutual defense pact with Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have long-range missiles, but no nuclear weapons that anybody knows about. Will Saudi Arabia fund their nuclear weapons development in Pakistan? Keep in mind always, both countries are unbearably hot a lot of the time. Both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia have recorded temperatures as high as 53 degrees C or 128.8 Fahrenheit, and that's in the shade. The last few years have been brutally hot. This year has been super hot. How does that change what people do? In 2015, the New York Times wrote, "Searing temperatures, which have been as high as 113 degrees Fahrenheit or 45 degrees C, a sense of panic and crisis persisted in Karachi, the country's financial and commercial capital, as well as the capital of Sindh province," end quote from the Times. More than 1,300 people died in that one heat wave in Karachi. In 2025, the New York Times reports, since 1960, Karachi's mean nighttime temperatures have risen by about 4.3 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 2.4 degrees Celsius. Daytime highs have risen by about 2.9 degrees Fahrenheit, studies show. Globally, temperatures have risen by about 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit since 1900, end quote from the Times. In 2016, we got a report directly from Karachi. This is from Radio EcoShock in June 2016. Our guest is the Dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. He's a professor of international relations concerning Earth and the environment. And Dr. Adil Najam was a vice chancellor at Lahore University of Management Sciences in Pakistan.
In Pakistan and Karachi's case, the perfect storm happened because this also came in the midst of the Muslim month of Ramadan, which is a month of fasting. And what that meant was that there were people who were fasting for religious reasons, who were trying to sort of push themselves harder. More than that, the infrastructure of support that is already missing in a poor country, especially for the poorest people, became even weaker. So all of these things combined to create this sort of massive wave and this number of, a very large number of people who died because of it. And it literally shook not just the large city of Karachi, but the country.
And just so we know, how many people live in Karachi?
Karachi is one of the largest cities in the world. You have certainly upwards of 10 million people living in this city. And I say that without precision because Pakistan has not had a census for a very long time. And the number of people who are kind of undocumented is even larger. So my own guess is we are talking about closer to 15 rather than 10 million people.
And is electricity for fans or air conditioning reliable in Karachi?
No, it is not. It is not reliable anywhere in Pakistan. But here is the thing. Anyone who can afford a air conditioner, which is very, very few people, and now I'm talking in single-digit percentages, can probably afford to run it because they'll also afford a generator of some sort. Anyone who can afford a fan, and that is not something that everyone would have, probably is still has some infrastructure to be able to survive and deal with this heat. The real issue is, and this is really the nub of climate change, that most people in a city like Karachi, but most people in this in the world, do not have the paraphernalia of dealing with these things that you and I might take for granted, right? We would take it for granted that, yes, you are poor, but that means you'll probably have a fan. Well, that's just not true for most people, not only in Karachi, but actually in the world.
And you have said half the deaths were preventable. What should national and state governments do to prepare for more heat events?
Well, I think all of the deaths are preventable. First of all, I am convinced that at least part of this, and we cannot say which part, is related to climate change. And if this is not, we would see more and more of that. And that means there's blood on your hands and mine. Right. So first, let's just start with that, that this is not just nature happening on its own. This is you and I and those of us particularly who are more affluent having outsourced our misery by our lack of action on climate change.
That's so true. Well, it isn't just the heat. The 2010 floods in Pakistan were devastating. It must take years for the country to recover from such weather extremes, and I assume some farmers and families never do.
Some don't, but here is the sad thing about the flood. The 2010 floods, and we are now in 2016, never ended. What do I mean by that? We are now in the sixth consecutive year of floods. And now it doesn't even make the news. So there were multiple hundreds of people who died earlier this year in April in this year's flood. So every year since 2010, now the floods have kind of become this repetitive thing. And at least part of that is the melting of the glaciers up in the Himalayas, again, possibly with impact from climate change. And if you think about it, you know, I'm guessing your listeners are thinking, well, I didn't hear about them. That's because most people didn't hear about them. Even in Pakistani newspapers, it no longer makes news if 100 people die because of floods. And you kind of internalize this as if this is a new normal. Well, dying people should never be a normal. And it's not just the floods. We are also now in the fourth year of a drought in another part of Pakistan, in Thar, where children keep dying literally every day. And that also doesn't make news. And so this, to me, is the reality of a world with climate change. It is not simply the reality that there is more death and destruction and disaster. It is also the reality that you become immune to being moved by that death and destruction. It becomes a new normal, and we keep moving on as if, okay, this is how it was supposed to be. So if you look around the world at these climate-induced disasters, and you look at all of them together, you suddenly see, well, there's something happening. But we are also like that frog in boiling water, getting used to this as if, well, this is how it is. And that is a tragedy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Adil Najam. We're talking about Pakistan in the new age of global heat. That was from 2016. Get the full 26-minute interview with Ajit Najam at ecoshock.org. The worst for Pakistan, maybe the worst anywhere, has to be the floods of 2010, called super floods. 20 million people were displaced, as almost a third of the country went underwater. And a third of Pakistan was underwater again in 2022, another super flood. It killed at least 1,700 people and affected 33 million people. At least 700 died in the summer of 2025 as weird extreme rains turned into flash floods and landslides. Whole villages were wiped out. In between, drought lasting years has plagued other parts of the country, with agriculture endangered. Compound events are increasing, like heat waves melting glaciers, which then flood everything below. Getting back to geopolitics amid disaster, Pakistan is supposed to be a U.S. ally. It was chosen over India. Pakistan's army chief was just in the White House, and Pakistan got a better tariff deal than India. That development so affronted India, Indian Prime Minister Modi went to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit. That was in China, August 31st to September 1st. Russia, North Korea, and Iran were featured guests, but dozens of countries attended. Saudi Arabia was there as a dialogue partner, not a signed-up member of the SCO. Not yet. One aim is for China to create a world economic system outside American dominance. As Al Jazeera put it, Xi, Putin, and Modi pledge unity at summit to counter U.S.-led global order. So Pakistan has a population of around 250 million people. Millions of Pakistanis live in enclaves in other countries. They are among our families and friends. We share this world in 100 ways. Their fate and response are part of a rising tide of challenge and distress in the real world, and we will all become part of that. Thank you for your attention to this matter. Thanks for listening and caring. We go out with the test. I cannot decide between two versions of a song covering hot nights, the global warming phenomenon increasing around the world. The lyrics are by Alex Smith and music by AI. First, we get the Dirty Delta Blues version, and then Suno creates an a cappella song, something it was unable to do a year ago.
Get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
My name is Jamie Hill. I'm the Design and Communications Manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all, and it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of a community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.